This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Lester Graham. On the show, we'll hear about the Army career and life of an African-American West Point graduate.
In 1948, Truman integrated the armed forces. Before that time, units in the military were segregated.
Then another invasive species could be making its way to Michigan.
And it feeds on practically any kind of species of tree and plant, and it's sucking the nutrients out of those plants as it feeds.
Also, we'll hear about Michigan's claim to fame when it comes to pickles.
I think the future of Michigan pickles will continue to be kind of this, no pun intended, bread and butter of large processing to supply companies like Heinz.
And our political commentators discuss an opinion from the Attorney General regarding petitions for ballot initiatives.
The opinion from the Attorney General really creates a lot of uncertainty.
All that plus a feature on veterans and beekeeping. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham, sitting in for Cynthia Canty on this Memorial Day. On today's program, don't let the spotted lanternfly's beautiful colors fool you. The invasive insect has already wreaked havoc in Pennsylvania and other Northeast states.
And it feeds on practically any kind of species of tree and plant, so it has a very broad host range, and it's sucking the nutrients out of those plants as it feeds.
We'll hear about the damage the spotted lanternfly could cause if it makes its way to Michigan. That's later in the hour. But first, in Lansing, there's a lot going on regarding petitions for citizens' initiatives, and here to talk about that are our Friday political commentators, except it's Monday. Ken Sikkema, senior policy fellow with Public Sector Consultants and a former Republican majority leader in the state Senate, is joining us, as well as Vicki Barnett, a former mayor of Farmington Hills and a former Democratic legislator. Ken, let's start with Attorney General Dana Nessel's formal opinion on a Republican-backed law that would make petition drives more difficult. Nessel found some parts of that law were unconstitutional. What did you think of that opinion?
Well, I don't think anybody was really surprised with her opinion. I mean, it's important because her opinion at this point sets the rules for petition gathering. And I think that the key to her opinion is she ruled or opined, if you will, that the requirement that you can't get more than 15% of your signatures from any one congressional district, she ruled that unconstitutional, which, if that were not unconstitutional, I mean, it would make it harder, if you will, and more expensive to get these signatures. But, you know, that's her opinion, and until some court overrules it, it's the law.
Vicki, what was the reasoning behind Attorney General Nessel's opinion?
Her reasoning was that you can't put further restrictions on a constitutional right. And I think that there were two important parts of the law that was passed during lame duck session last year that she ruled were unconstitutional. One was that 15% threshold per congressional district. And the other was the requirement that if you're going to be a paid circulator, you need to file an affidavit saying that you're going to be a paid circulator, and that there's a checkbox on the proposal page that people sign on the petition that will show that you are a paid circulator. And again, she ruled that unconstitutional. I think she did the right thing. I was surprised when the governor signed this. The problem with the 15% threshold, especially this year when we now have a court ruling that our districts are unconstitutionally gerrymandered, would make this an absolute nightmare for anybody trying to exercise their petition rights.
All right, you two. Now, neither one of you is a lawyer, but how much legal weight is given to a formal opinion of an attorney general?
Well, her opinion is basically the law until it's overturned. You know, it certainly binds all state agencies, and that would include the Secretary of State and the State Board of Canvassers that are in charge of, you know, overseeing the petition gathering process. You know, the theory behind this 15% limitation is that there ought to be some geographical diversity required when you gather signatures. Other states that allow for this have this sort of geographical diversity requirement. But until it's overturned, her opinion has the effect of law.
Vicki, the sponsor of the legislation to restrict petition drives for citizen initiatives wants the speaker to challenge the opinion in court. What do you think is going to happen there?
I think he's probably going to challenge it in court. I wouldn't be surprised. The legislature has a claim on their right to amend laws and to make law. And it's just going to further delay the process for anybody trying to put something on the ballot for the year 2020 election.
Well, let's talk about that, because right now there are two different petition drives in the works, one by Quicken Loans billionaire Dan Gilbert, who wants to make major changes to auto no-fault insurance, which, by the way, might not matter that much since the governor and the legislative leaders have struck a deal on an auto insurance overhaul. The other petition drive is by an anti-abortion group, or a couple of them, actually, who want to severely restrict abortion in Michigan. Both are attempts to circumvent vetoes by the governor, because as soon as enough signatures are gathered and it goes to the ballot, the legislature can take it up and pass it, and the governor has no role. So, Ken, the Republicans want to restrict citizen initiatives as of last session, but now it appears they're embracing citizen initiatives. Is this a new strategy we're seeing?
Well, the opinion from the Attorney General really creates a lot of uncertainty, because the question becomes, what are the rules that you have to use when you're out there gathering signatures? Now, right now, it's her opinion that decides the rules. But if it's overturned in a court, let's say arguably next fall or next winter, then maybe it's a different set of rules. And the problem it creates is the summertime is the best time for gathering these signatures. So if you're looking at putting something on the ballot in the November 2020 election, you want this summer to gather those signatures, because you only have a 180-day window to do it. So it does create a lot of uncertainty. I think, in the words of one of the members of the State Board of Canvassers, it's a real quagmire, and I agree it is.
Vicki, what do you think of this workaround to cut out the chance of a veto from the governor?
I think this is really against the intent of the constitutional right of people to petition their government through legislation or changes in the Constitution. And in fact, all three of these proposals that you just talked about, the two that are being driven by Right to Life of Michigan and another group, as well as Dan Gilbert's work around the auto no-fault, are all designed to get a simple majority of the vote of the legislature and take the governor out of the works completely. And generally, that's not the goal of a petition drive. And in fact, the people who sign petitions for sick leave and for minimum wage increases in 2018 that should have been on the ballot were short-circuited by the legislature and then drastically changed. And I don't think the people that signed those petitions had anticipated that or had wanted that.
Ken, I think it's worth noting that Attorney General Nessel's opinion did find several aspects of the Republican-backed law were constitutional. What do you make of that?
Well, she distinguished between what she called, I think, process requirements, just sort of making sure the thing works smoothly, and substantive constitutional issues. And so, yeah, she ruled that some of the changes were, you know, basically sort of technical and process related, but the ones she ruled on constitutional, she felt restricted the right of the voters to go this route of voter-initiated amendments and laws.
Vicki, I think some observers were looking at that going, wow, we thought she'd just say the whole darn thing is no good, and that's what they expected, and yet it seemed to be a little more refined than that. What'd you make of it?
Well, there was a distinction between, as Ken said, the process part of this and the free speech rights of individuals. And that's where she really centered on people's constitutional free speech rights to pass petitions, to sign petitions, and to guarantee that something gets on the ballot. The things that she left in place were font size of the petition, how the petition is laid out, going to the State Board of Canvassers, which don't really impact that constitutional right directly. So I think she made the right choice. She didn't just throw it all out, because there were some good things in there, like font size, making sure that people can read the heading on a petition and can read the language on a petition. But let's talk, I really would want to talk about this 15% threshold just a little more, because especially of the complications of the gerrymandering lawsuit, where all of our congressional lines and state rep lines and state senate lines are going to be majorly overhauled. That means that people in the state, especially Southeast Michigan, where these caps are really going to be important if they are remaining in place on the 15% threshold. It means that those lines are movable, that what somebody signs today as a 15% threshold, especially in Oakland County, may find themselves in a different congressional district, which throws everything up in the air and really denies the ability of people to exercise their free speech rights and their constitutional rights to sign petitions. And that currently, the requirement for signatures on petition drives are organized by county. And those county lines are not up for question in gerrymandering or congressional districts. Those lines aren't moving. And so those are the standard we used prior to this law, and that's the standard we should continue to use.
Well, and the other reason I think Vicki's right is congressional lines are going to change every 10 years.
Well, they're going to change every 2 years for the next four.
Yeah, I mean, so, you know, but county lines aren't going to change. So, I mean, I don't quite understand why they picked congressional districts last fall when they passed it versus county. You know, as I mentioned, there a lot of states that allow for this actually do have these geographical diversity requirements, but most of them, to my memory, use counties.
Ken, regarding that, that's a lot we're juggling for this summer. What would you do if you were drafting a petition for a ballot initiative?
I think if I were interested in a petition drive of one sort or another, I'd want to get this in front of the state Supreme Court, sort of ASAP, and have them make a ruling whether she's right or the statute passed last fall is going to control, because the summer, as I pointed out, is a key time for getting signatures. And if you lose the bulk of this summer, it's hard to do everything in a 180-day window, which includes the winter time. So I'd want to get in front of the state Supreme Court as quickly as possible.
That is Ken Sikkema. He's Senior Policy Fellow with Public Sector Consultants and a former Republican Majority Leader in the State Senate. And we heard from Vicki Barnett. She's a former mayor of Farmington Hills and a former Democratic legislator. Thanks, you two.
Thank you.
Thanks, Lester.
Coming up, why Michigan is the center of the pickleverse.
Temperature-wise, soil-wise, all of that is just great for growing vegetables in general and pickles in particular.
That's after the break. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Maybe you already knew this, but I just read that Michigan is the nation's biggest pickle producer, by far. I found out in a Crain's Detroit Business article written by Nina Mizoraka Ignazik, and she joins us now. So this idea came from your editor, who, as I understand it, is the daughter of Cy Ginsburg. And so for those of us who don't know about Cy Ginsburg's deli and its relationship to pickles, maybe you could explain that for us.
So Cy Ginsburg is a beloved brand of corned beef. And it's kind of ironic because my editor, his daughter, Amy Elliott Bragg, is a vegetarian. But she came up with this idea as part of Crain's food economy series and really just wanted to focus in on pickles as one way to look at how Michigan's food economy works. She was very excited when her editor said yes to this. So this was like a dream project for her and for me.
So how long have pickles been a thing in Michigan?
So pickles have been a thing in Michigan since before World War I. In fact, they started growing pickles in Michigan around 1907 in the Benton Harbor area, southwest Michigan, and just started growing more pickles, more pickle facilities. And then after World War II, the industry also started growing in the Saginaw Bay area.
Yeah, you were saying that there were two main pickle growing belts in Michigan. I guess those are the two places. Why, though? Why in Michigan?
So Michigan is a great place to grow crops, period. We're one of the most diverse agricultural states after California. We have a 10 million acre agricultural industry here. We have well-drained sandy soil, which is great for pickles. We have high humidity, which they also like. So temperature-wise, soil-wise, all of that is just great for growing vegetables in general and pickles in particular.
So was there a particular ethnicity who came to Michigan and said, you know, what this state really needs is some pickling?
So the pickle industry did get going before kind of the great migration of Eastern Europeans and particularly European Jews came to this country. But when the European Jews came to the country, they brought some of the recipes that we're more familiar with today, like kosher pickles and that sort of thing. So it sort of all built out itself. It was here before they got here, but once the Europeans got here, they kind of expanded it.
You think of pickles as being pretty robust. I mean, they last forever in the refrigerator, right? We have to remember, though, that pickles are made from cucumbers, and I guess harvesting cucumbers has a really short window. Why is that?
Yeah, so I spoke to a seed expert about that, and he told me that you could be in a field in the morning and the cucumbers aren't quite ready, but by 8 o'clock that evening, they could be ready to go. And for that reason, most of the cucumbers in Michigan, 35,000 acres of cucumbers that we grow here, are harvested mechanically with these giant combines that sort of drive through the fields and scoop up the cucumbers. So it can happen in a very, very short window of time. And for that reason, there's really no farm labor involved in it. It's more labor to sort what comes in from the harvest from the combines.
I would think that they'd have to be pretty close to the processors too if they're such a delicate fruit.
Yeah, so that's sort of how the pickle engine works here in Michigan. The growers get started, and actually in an old Detroit Free Press report that I found, they talked about shipping these cucumbers by tank to Detroit for sorting. But at some point, the processors got smart and started building giant silos, either they're wood or fiberglass, half underground or above ground, out where the pickles are being grown. And so just when, you know, sort of snowballs from there.
These silos are like, that's where the brine is, the salt water?
Yeah, so they're giant vats, basically, of super saturated salt solution that can preserve the pickles for long periods of time. And as those facilities got built and all that infrastructure was there, then more pickle growers would locate themselves close to that and sort of just fed off of each other. And now we have kind of these two centers in the state where there's growers and storage in close proximity to each other.
So they're in the brine, but they're not dill pickle or bread and butter pickles yet. What happens from there?
So from there, the pickle growers and processors will ship them out to various customers, like in the case of Swanson's Pickles, which is located in southwest Michigan. They have two main customers. One is Heinz, which is located in Holland, and the other one is Treehouse, which is located in Green Bay, Wisconsin. And so they ship those out to those facilities, and those facilities will do whatever they do. They'll add spices, salts, they'll cure them, they'll put vinegar in, whatever their unique recipes are. They'll make relish, all of the different things that pickles are used for.
I literally laughed out loud when you said the ugly pickles get to be relish.
Yes. So I spoke with Katie Hensley of Swanson Pickles, and she was mentioning that very, very little of the actual harvest is discarded. Maybe there's just some chaff that comes in from the field, but any pickle can be used for some purpose.
So we're the number one pickle manufacturer in the nation, but how much of the market do we own?
So in 2018, Michigan produced 27% of the harvest in the United States, and that was about 27% more than Florida, which is our next closest competitor.
Wow. One of your sources said something like, Michigan is the center of the Pickleverse. What does that even mean?
So the Pickleverse is something that came from Larry Toper, and it basically just describes this kind of ecosystem of pickle growing, manufacturing, but also kind of the culture behind it and the stories that people like Larry Toper bring from his grandmother, Lily Toper, who brought the recipes over. So it's a culture, it's an infrastructure, it's growers, it's sort of the whole shebang.
Pickling and fermentation of all kinds have become really popular in the local food movement, and pickles range from those kind on the store shelf that we're used to seeing that last forever to refrigerated pickles now, which have been around for quite a while. And now we see day pickles made in restaurants and served with hamburgers and stuff. How are pickle tastes changing?
So I think people are growing in their appreciation for craft foods and for fermentation in particular. I think over the last decade or so, we've all come to appreciate the idea of probiotics. And as Jason Grobel pointed out to me, you may think eating yogurt that you're getting probiotics, but you're probably not. However, if you eat Topper's brand of fermented barrel pickles, which are a little scary, I bought my first jar actually last week, and they're cloudy. They look a little weird, but they taste amazing, and they're full of probiotics. And that's sort of where I think some of the tastes are going. People are appreciating those old recipes and the health benefits that they bring along with them.
What did they taste like?
They're tangy, and it's hard to describe. You really just have to taste one.
Okay, all right. Well, there's another thing for the bucket list, I guess. So where is the future of pickles in Michigan going?
I think the future of Michigan pickles will continue to be kind of this, no pun intended, bread and butter of large processing to supply companies like Heinz and the bigger producers. But there will also be more room for people to experiment with their family recipes to sort of get that out there. The shorter, less shelf stable fermented pickles, I think, are going to be a big opportunity going forward for kind of small scale production.
We've been talking to Nina Mizorakan-Ignazik, who wrote an article for Crain's Detroit Business titled "Why Michigan is the Center of the Pickleverse." Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Biologists are keeping an eye out for yet another invasive species, and they're asking for you to keep an eye out for it, too. It's called the spotted lanternfly. One of the states hit hard by the spotted lanternfly is Pennsylvania. Heather Leach is with the Department of Entomology at Penn State, and she joins us now. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Lester. Thanks for having me.
So first, where did this insect originate, and how did it get to the U.S.?
Yeah, so it's a great question. So the spotted lanternfly is native to certain parts of Asia. It has a very cryptic egg stage, and so we believe it was imported here on stone, and nobody noticed it until it was able to hatch out in the spring and start feeding on our plants here.
On stone, I would have thought like wood pallets or something. Well, it's interesting how these things get in here, but it's always the same basic route from Europe or Asia and into the U.S. ports, and then it goes wherever it goes from there. How far has it spread in the U.S. so far?
So right now it's just in the northeastern part of the U.S., so the biggest population is in Pennsylvania, but it is spreading to some of the nearby states, so New Jersey, Delaware, Maryland, and Virginia also all have populations.
Can you describe what it looks like? People tell me it's pretty.
Yeah, it can be very pretty, at least when there's not hundreds of them. So a lot of people mistake it for a moth. It's actually a plant hopper insect. So it's a very strong jumper, and they're also very colorful. So both in the nymph stage and in the adult stage, they're bright red in some cases and have these very iridescent white spots in other cases.
So I understand that it can travel, as you said, as a leaf hopper, but it also can travel on wood, I suppose, or stone, as you mentioned. So how does it spread?
Yeah, so they're excellent hitchhikers is what we're learning so far. So they lay their eggs pretty much indiscriminately on any surface. So we're very worried about transport of anything that, you know, we're shipping out of Pennsylvania, but also in Asia. So if they're laying their egg masses on something that we might not know about and then it gets moved to, say, Michigan, that's a big problem for us.
What kind of damage does the spotted lanternfly do?
Yeah, so a spotted lanternfly is a piercing, sucking insect. So it feeds on the plant sap or plant phloem, and it feeds on practically any kind of species of tree and plant. So it has a very broad host range, and it's sucking the nutrients out of those plants as it feeds.
So it's pretty indiscriminate. I understand that it damages grapevines, orchards, your ornamental trees in your yard. How bad could this get?
Well, we're still trying to figure that out, so that's a great question. But so far, we're extremely concerned about ornamental and landscape trees, even forest regeneration. But we're also really closely watching vineyards and damages in grape, and that's where we've seen the worst economic damage so far from this pest.
Tell me about that. What's happening?
Yeah, so spotted lanternfly, so high of populations get into these vineyards, and we start to see depletion of nutrients on these vines. They start to get very unhealthy, and then the following year, with all of that feeding damage, we actually see these vines either don't produce any grapes the following year, or they're just completely dead.
Besides piercing, they also have this excrement, right, that bothers the plants?
Yeah, so as they're feeding, they're getting a lot of nutrients from that plant, but they're also getting a lot of sugar water, and so they're excreting that continuously. And so we call that honeydew, and other kind of closely related insects like aphids will do this as well. But with spotted lanternfly, it's on a whole nother level. And so we see large amounts of honeydew, kind of this sugary water around where they're feeding. So this builds up, and we actually start to get mold growth on top of that, what we call sooty mold. So people's decks, their backyards, their picnic tables, but even the grapevines get covered with this black mold substance.
So what am I looking for if I'm looking for the damage it does?
Well, it's actually very hard to see. So it's what we call an indirect feeder. So it's not feeding directly on that grapefruit. It's actually feeding on the vines and on the shoots of that grape plant. So they're sticking their kind of piercing, sucking mouth part in, kind of think like a mosquito, but feeding on a plant. So it's really difficult to really see the damage until you have a very weak-looking plant.
Are there natural enemies at all or organic ways to keep the spotted lanternfly from damaging trees and crops?
Unfortunately, we don't have great control options at this point. Because it's an invasive, it means we don't have any predators or parasitoids that are going to be attacking it here in any real way. But we are trying to understand what we can potentially bring from Asia that can help destroy its populations here as well.
What kind of preventative measures are being used right now?
Well, unfortunately, there's really no way to prevent spotted lanternfly from coming into your vineyard, coming onto your property. So the best options that we have right now are chemical control.
Well, that gets expensive, right?
It does. It gets very expensive for the homeowner, for the grape grower, and it's really difficult to, you know, continuously make these sprays, because what we're seeing is that even when you kill spotted lanternfly in your neighborhood, you get this reinfestation from the surrounding landscape just a couple of days later. So it's really putting a lot of stress on these people dealing with high populations.
How much can this cost vineyards or orchard growers? I mean, do we have an estimate on how much damage in dollars and cents it's done so far?
Yeah, so we're seeing an almost 200% increase in insecticide application cost from spotted lanternfly alone just in the past 2 years. So per acre cost has gone from $54 to $147 an acre for these grape growers to actually try to maintain control and keep spotted lanternfly from damaging their vineyard.
So when we're talking about an invasive pest like this, I mean, you have this idea that they're just swarming in. But what's it actually like on the ground in Pennsylvania?
Well, you know, you don't really start to notice them until you get to that adult life stage. They get very active at this point. They can fly, glide, hop. So it's actually, in some cases, difficult to go outside of your house without getting smacked in the head with one of them, believe it or not.
Besides the way they look, is there anything else we can do to determine if we're starting to get hit by them? You said it was really hard to see the damage they do. I'm trying to figure out what we should be looking for if we want to tell the scientists and biologists in our area that we think we have them.
Yeah, that's a great question. And the best way to really keep that preventative approach is to look out for the various life stages of spotted lanternfly. So learn what they look like. Again, they're when they're nymphs and adults, they're very easy to identify because they're so colorful and strange looking. And so it's best to really take a look at that next time you go out on a hike, next time you go to the lakes, take a look and try to find this insect. And if you do see it, report it to the Michigan Department of Agriculture.
Is this a matter of not if, but when for Michigan?
Unfortunately, I think so. I'm actually a proud Michigander myself, and I desperately want to keep it out of Michigan. But when we're dealing with an insect population that's this high and also fairly cryptic as its egg mass stage, and it is a good hitchhiker, we end up in a situation where it can get very difficult to control. So it's likely not if, but when.
You know, in some cases, we've seen going back to the country of origin or the region of origin, they've been able to find something that would defeat them. I think they did that with gypsy moths, right? They found something that killed gypsy moths.
Yep.
Is there a way we can do this with lanternfly?
I hope so. So we have some great researchers on our team who have gone to areas in China to look for natural enemies that we can potentially introduce. We actually have two different wasp species that are already in a U.S. quarantine facility that are currently undergoing testing. And we've also found a couple of pathogen species, so fungi that are attacking spotted lanternfly, already in Pennsylvania. So we're really hoping that we can gather as much research as possible and try to use these control methods to really use sustainable long-term control against this bug.
Now, I don't have to tell you, but sometimes we brought in enemies of a pest and then they turned out to be a worse problem than the original pest. So how do you guys work with that these days, knowing that that has happened in the past?
Absolutely. That's a great question. It basically means we have to be very careful, and it means that anything that's currently in our quarantine facility has to undergo very long-term intense testing to make sure that it's not going to cause any damage itself. So while we're worried about getting rid of spotted lanternfly, we also have to look at any potential damage it might cause to some of our native insects and even native plants and make sure it won't cause any damage there.
Yeah, so, problem of unintended consequences.
Absolutely, yep. We want to make sure that doesn't happen and do this in the most intelligent way possible.
Oh, man. You're just full of good news. That's Heather Leach. She's with the Department of Entomology at Penn State. We've been talking about the spotted lanternfly, an invasive insect which damages trees, orchards, vineyards. It's not in Michigan yet, but it probably will be very soon, and that's why scientists and biologists are asking you to keep an eye out. Hey, thanks for giving us a heads up about this, Heather.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Lester.
Coming up, we talk with retired Army officer Clifford Worthy. His new book outlines his military career starting in the late 1940s before desegregation.
In 1948, Truman integrated the armed forces. Before that time, units in the military were segregated. Even black units were commanded by white officers.
That conversation after the break. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. Welcome back to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham, sitting in for Cynthia Canty. It's Memorial Day, a day to remember those who have died in military service. This next story is about what happens once veterans leave military service. Many struggle to return to civilian life. One Michigan man found a way to make the transition a little bit easier. He did it through beekeeping. And now he's training other vets across the nation. Interlochen Public Radio's Dan Wanchura has the story.
His name is Adam Ingrail, and he joined the Army right after 9/11. He was in his early 20s and planned to make it his career. He completed training to be a Patriot missile controller, but then, just before deployment, Adam blew out his ankle in a training accident.
It was an injury that could have probably been dealt with in an appropriate manner, but unfortunately was misdiagnosed by the doctors in the Army and ended up turning into a permanent disability.
Adam was devastated. He came from a military family and didn't know what else to do. And so at 25, Adam was discharged from the Army.
It went from having, all of my battle buddies to me being back home, living with my parents again, and all my battle buddies are in Iraq and Afghanistan fighting, and that's where I wanted to be too.
Depression set in, and Adam struggled to find purpose in life. Then, in 2009, he decided to use his GI Bill to go back to school. He went to California Polytechnic State University to study agriculture and plant science, and his first semester there, he took a course in beekeeping. He says that course changed his life.
I remember the first day I came home from that first beekeeping experience, I was, just ear to ear with smiles, and I just knew this is what I wanted to do.
Adam says it helped him switch from the fast-paced lifestyle of the military to a more normal, mindful pace.
You have to slow down, because if you don't slow down, the bees are going to let you know you're moving too fast, and they're going to sting you.
It's a brisk and sunny midweek morning on Traverse City's Old Mission Peninsula. Adam Ingrail is now an agricultural entomologist and veteran liaison at Michigan State University. And right now, he's getting ready to check out some brightly painted beehives.
So one of the first things that I always like to do as we're getting in here is just kind of evaluate what's going on in this colony. So this colony made it through the winter, and we'll be likely taking some splits from this colony, which basically means we're going to take this one colony and turn it into a couple of them. We'll do that here in a couple weeks.
Adam says when he works with bees, he feels inspired by a sense of mission, similar to how he felt when he was in the military. He needs the bees, and it turns out the bees need him. That's because since the 1950s, the honeybee population in the U.S. has dropped by more than half. That's so low that about 70% of the country's domesticated honeybees get shipped out to California each year just to pollinate the almond crop there.
And Dan, I'm going to have you move around this side.
Okay.
Otherwise, you're going to start getting a pile of bees hanging out behind you.
Okay.
As they're coming in and out of the hive.
There are many factors contributing to this, but Adam says the main cause of honeybee decline is pests and pathogens. He says one solution to those problems is beekeepers who are better educated. In 2015, Adam started Heroes to Hives, a program that trains military vets in beekeeping and helps them with personal wellness.
I don't know if I would have been as ready to put myself out there and start training veterans around this if I didn't have an experience that was just transformative for myself.
One of Adam's former students is Kevin Brown. Kevin lives in Marion, Michigan, and completed two tours in the Middle East as a member of the National Guard. After each deployment, he struggled with anxiety and reintegrating into family life. But he says the Heroes to Hives program offers a healing camaraderie with the other vets.
You go out to a bee yard and you're focusing on the bees, all of a sudden there might be a conversation strike up. And without even you knowing it, you are letting a lot of stress go that you didn't know you had.
Adam Ingrao says beekeeping is a way for veterans to continue serving their country by being a solution to the honeybee crisis and helping them pollinate our crops.
They have the dedication to duty, they have the honor, the selfless service, all of those basic skills that they drill into you in the military. Those are all skills that transfer exactly over to being a beekeeper.
Heroes to Hive started with 5 vets at Adam's farm in Lansing and has now expanded to over 200 vets in 25 states. Adam hopes it'll continue spreading to more states in the future. For Stateside, I'm Dan Wanchura.
Before desegregation in the armed forces in 1948, very few African Americans were given the opportunity to attend West Point. My next guest started his journey toward West Point prior to desegregation. He's written a book about that and his military career, but it's also a book about family and faith. The title of the book is The Black Knight, An African American Family's Journey from West Point, A Life of Duty, Honor, and Country. The author is Clifford Worthy, and he joins us now. Thanks very much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
The foreword of your book was written by the recently departed John Dingell Jr. What was your connection to the former representative?
John Dingell Jr. was the son of John Dingell Sr., who was the one who appointed me to West Point in 1949.
Yeah, John Dingell Sr. was a congressman until 1955.
Yes.
So, yeah. Historically, how were the handful of African Americans who went to West Point treated?
They were what was called silenced. No one spoke to them. They stayed in a room by themselves. They ate by themselves. The only contact they had with the other cadets was through academics and military training. But other than that, they were isolated, so to speak.
Having heard that, I'm wondering what your time was like at West Point.
Well, I think West Point took seriously the edict that came from President Truman. In 1948, Truman integrated the armed forces. Before that time, units in the military were segregated. Even black units were commanded by white officers. So it was that was the situation. Now, when I got there, I think West Point had got the message, even though there had been resistance, obviously, at that time. But I never felt any serious problem with racism while I was there.
And that you got there in 1949.
Yeah.
The primary title is The Black Knight. What does that mean?
Well, the motto or the, much like Michigan Wolverines, cadets were
so
called
the cadets, the Black Knights.
Black Knights.
You did run into some Jim Crow incidents while you're early in the service, not in the Army base itself, but traveling.
Yes.
In the South and the West.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell me about one of those experiences?
Yeah, one of those was, we were traveling, going from Detroit at that time to Camp Carson. It was called Camp Carson. Now it's Fort Carson. It took us through a little town called Clayton, New Mexico. When we got there, we needed gas, and so I stopped at a gas station, asked the attendant if where we could get something to eat. Clearly, he saw that we were black, but he didn't indicate it made a difference to him. So he just told us the name of a local restaurant that we were there. I still had my New York license plate on my car, and so we went to this restaurant, and as I walked in the front door, it was a very cheery, lively group of people there, and they were having a good time, typically. But as soon as I walked in the door, everything went dead silent. Even the people, the black people who were keeping the place clean, stopped and stared. Well, I knew, kind of figured I was in trouble. Well, I left my wife out in the car because back in those days, you had to take those kinds of precautions, particularly in the South. The lady that served me, she flabbergasted that I would even be there. She said, "Don't you know you're not supposed to be here, boy? You know, you go around to the back." And she was really upset. For some strange reason, the manager or the owner said, "Go ahead and give him what he wants." And that really set her off. And she threw the hamburgers at me that I had ordered. And as I was about to leave, you could hear the chairs in there. And as I walked out the door, there was people clearly following me outside. I went back, got in the car, drove, and I knew I was in trouble because if I could look behind me, there's a pickup truck, so the lights start flashing, and there was like a convoy of people, a truck behind me. I couldn't get any help because if it was a chief of police there, he probably would have been leading the convoy. Anyway, I started to drive away, and they followed me down the road. But I got to a point, and for some reason, they stopped and started turning around. But I assumed it was because I was near the border. But anyway, that was a scary moment because I had no idea what would have happened had I not been at that particular spot.
Did you face any kind of racism in the military in the 1950s or 1960s?
Not that I'm aware of. Now, I know that's hard to believe. Kind of subtly, yes. For instance, during the summer as a cadet, we would go to different bases for training purposes. And I remember being in El Paso, Texas, going there and going across the border to Juarez with my classmates, being refused service even there in Mexico. And clearly it wasn't the service, it was just the policy at that time. So there were other similar instances like that. There used to be social programs by these little towns that we would visit. And then one time we were going to one little town and they were giving a party for the cadets as they came in. They bussed in the girls from the town for the cadets. But in our case, we were given staff cars, pick up our dates, which for a change was to our advantage. But that kind of thing took place.
Yeah, you mentioned in the book, as I was reading, that there were a couple of bases where you were suddenly found that all of the black families lived in one block on base, things like that. And I just thought, wow, that's hard to excuse after desegregation, right? You did a couple of stints overseas. One was in Germany during the Cold War in 1957. Mm-hmm. The other was in Vietnam in 1968. Mm-hmm. What did you learn from those experiences?
I learned, one, how resourceful the American GIs are. You know, it wasn't the Hollywood type shoot 'em up type things you see about Vietnam. I saw that too. But it was just how American soldiers were able to cope with whatever the situation was, find a solution to whatever problem they were faced with. That was one thing that impressed me. And there are many others.
Let's talk about your family, because your family, for the most part, moved from Army base to Army base. Of course, they didn't go to Vietnam, but they did go with you to Germany and spent some time there. Your first child, Mark, was born with special needs, and being in the military, that was difficult for you and especially difficult for your wife, Lillian. Lillian passed away fairly early in your life. You also have two daughters, Kim and Jennifer. Most of us know about Kim Worthy because of her work as Wayne County prosecutor. So Lillian died while your daughters were in school, Jennifer in high school, Kim in college. How did that affect you and your kids?
Well, unfortunately, my wife came up with a medical condition that she was losing her balance was deteriorating, and she had some difficulty in negotiating steps. And anyway, our next door neighbor at the time was the neurosurgeon, and he examined her and decided that she had undue pressure in the vertebrae. And so he recommended some surgery, but he wanted me to get a second opinion, so he sent me to the University of Oklahoma Medical Center in Oklahoma City, which is about 100 miles away. And the doctor there just decided the same thing and decided for surgery. I mention that because at that time, Kim was at the University of Michigan. And based on the information I had at that time, I didn't see there was any need for her to leave school to come to Oklahoma where we were. And that might have been a bad decision because Kim, when she lost her mother, which what happened, they did the surgery. She was paralyzed from the neck down, and they went back in and did the same thing, but it never helped. And of course, Kim was upset with me because I was never told about it. And the kids, I guess it was the minimal effect on my daughter Jennifer at the time. But later on, you could see that she had missed her mom. She was 14 years old when her mom died. That was a problem for her. And of course, for Kim, it was a problem because she felt that she should have known. In fact, she really wanted to accuse the surgeon of malpractice. Back in those days, you just took the surgeon's word. You didn't think about those things much.
As we've been talking, you've been rising in the ranks. Mm-hmm. By this point, you're a full bird colonel. Mm-hmm. You worked in the Pentagon, including serving with the Undersecretary of the Army. In all likelihood, you were on your way to becoming a general, but you retired. Why?
Well, I retired because I had a 14-year-old daughter and a son that needed help, and I just felt that I could be going all around the world with children who needed help and where help was not always available. And I thought best for them was for me to retire. So I did.
So I thoroughly enjoyed the book. I'm wondering, as an author, what do you want us to take from this book more than anything else?
I want young people, particularly young African-American kids, to know that sometimes things just happen. Sometimes opportunities are thrust upon you, much like it was for me. And you've got to be ready to stand in and take advantage of it. And then also I want them to understand that bad things happen. And I've mentioned bad things. We've talked about them here. People are, you know, particularly back in those days, that was pre-Martin Luther King days. But there were good people.
Yeah, we're not completely away from them.
Yeah. But there were some wonderful people that helped me along the way that were not at that time. And the doors opened for me, and I think I wanted the kids to know you have to take some risks sometime. And I was fortunate enough to do that and ended up with assignments like being sent to the University of Arizona for 2 years to get a master's in mechanical engineering, commanding a field artillery battalion in Vietnam, going to the Pentagon, and being a part of the Chief of Research and Development for a while, and then becoming one of the military assistants to the Undersecretary of the Army. Had tremendous assignments.
Yeah, those doors open, but you have to
walk through them. That's right. And yeah. I could go on and on. But you've got to walk through them. You've got to be willing to stand and take a chance and take advantage of those opportunities and treat them as achievable, not just saying, well, I'll never make it. You can make it.
We've been speaking to Clifford Worthy. He's written his life story in the book, The Black Knight, An African-American Family's Journey from West Point, A Life of Duty, Honor, and Country. Sir, thanks very much for sharing your book with us, and thanks for coming in.
Well, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
That's our show for today. Some of today's stories were previously aired on Stateside. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mike Blank, April Van Buren,
Sarah Leeson, and Mercedes Mejia. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening. Have a safe Memorial Day.